Welcome to the podcast. You've got two of us tonight. You've got myself with Stan the Fury Dragon. I'm the editor of the Ultima Codex, ultimacodex.com. Do a few other things here and there. We've also got Linguistic Dragon.
Hello, hello. It's me again. I am the author of the Ultima Journeys blog.
So, tonight we're going to talk about the thing that we were going to talk about last week. but then we decided to talk about Ultima 4 because it was Ultima 4's anniversary. But evidently a lot of people really liked that podcast because it got just really great listen counts on Podbean, actually. And actually, it seems that a number of people, after hearing the Ultima 4 podcast, decided to go and explore the last few episodes as well. So much so, actually, that episode 16 is no longer our most listened to episode. It's now episode 17, when we talk about combat and RPGs. So that's kind of cool.
Yes, it is.
But, yes, so... Starting off, actually, a couple of things. New patrons for a shout-out here. We have a couple new patrons on Patreon. Yes! On Patreon this week, we've got Chris Hopkins and Johnny Wood as our newest backers. So thank you both, Chris and Johnny. Your support will, I mean, it obviously helps keep the Ultimate Codex going. It brings us closer to being able to upgrade the hosting. And upgraded hosting means more RAM, more processing power. So the IRC channel might bump along a little bit faster. But more importantly, more storage space. Yes, to host files for all of those awesome Ultima fan projects that are out there. As well, Spam 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 Humbug itself has a few new followers on Podbean this week. We've got... I'm going to struggle with some of these names. I know it.
Well, that's
we've got Indy Curlew. We've got... I know, right? So we've got Indy Curlew. We've got One Planet. We've got Ishantech 1993. We've got P Missions. Silver Rainstone, Kigna Lauren, Pearls in Christ, Amanda M360, and we've also got the Gameshinery podcast. And I haven't listened to their first episode yet, but the Gameshinery website, which I believe is Gameshinery, GameTionary.io. Don't quote me on that. I'll get the correct link in the show notes if it isn't that. but their whole shtick seems to be that they're, you know, just a really... browsable tag-based reference library for games across a number of different platforms. And then, of course, you know, you can find like descriptions and screenshots and links to where you can buy those games.
Oh, that's useful.
I didn't notice any Ultima content. Yeah, I know. I didn't notice any Ultima content, but they seem to just be getting off
just
the ground.
Trying to fix
but they have a podcast too. Yes, definitely. Absolutely. I think actually they do take submissions. So
excellent.
Just saying. Someone with more time than me. Yes, someone with more time than me. Hit up Gameshinery and you know what to do. All right. And we actually have a couple of... a whole bunch of stuff happening on the Ultima Dragons front, actually. So we actually have a couple of new Ultima Dragons who have signed up over the last week. And this is on UDIC.org. So these are like, you know, the official list. Has some new entries on it. We've got Phoenix Dragon, who signed up on September 9th, and Summer Dragon, who signed up on the 17th. There's also several new members who've joined the Ultima Dragons Facebook group since our last episode. We've got Frank, we've got Randy, Matthias, Scott, David, and Bo, and Tracy Hickman is also in there now,
nice.
Too. So that's kind of cool. Additionally, on the Google Plus Ultima Dragons group, we have Alexandra, who has joined.
Good.
So welcome and splut to all. Yes, very nice. So it's nice to see that group grow, too, because it's always it's the smaller one of the two. Actually, too, and I'm going to make a note about this in the show notes right now. Small keyboard. There we go. Okay. On the Ultima Dragons Facebook group, Cranberry is running a survey right now in which she's basically asking, and actually I'm going to just click through and pull this one up because it's kind of cool. She's been doing a couple of cool things. Like, first off, for the last week and a bit now, she's been really hammering the chronological roster hard, looking for, you know, basically the current date. You know, so, you know, it's the 19th today? It's the 19th, yep, that we're recording this on. So she'll go through and she'll just do a search for September 19th all the way down the list. And then she'll post, you know, a little thing in the Facebook group, you know, that following dragons have this anniversary, whatever it might be. So that's kind of neat.
That's cool.
But also she's posted, yeah, but she's also posted a bit of a survey, which is basically, you know, she says, it seems we have a spate of new dragon joins to this Facebook UDIC group, which is terrific. So she's asking, how did you find this group, or what made you think to look for it? And some of the choices are, well, I'm an old dragon, and I searched for UDIC when I got to Facebook. That's the leading category. I was told it was here by a fellow dragon. I'm an old Ultima fan and went looking for an Ultima community. I'm a new dragon and was told about it when I was greeted. So that's actually really cool, too, is that, you know, the greeters at UDIC.org have really internalized. Oh, hey, we've got this Facebook group and it's awesome.
Yeah, they do.
I saw it referenced on a webs. Yes.
I was pointed toward cool. it myself when I joined, but I'm not on Facebook. So I'm one of those weird.
Yeah, we got to tell them about the Google Plus group. Hmm? We got to tell them about the Google Plus group.
Yes.
Yeah. Make a note. Yes.
And the wear mount.
And the wear mount, yes, that is also out there. I saw it referenced on a site like the Ultima Codex. I heard about it through other social media, Google Plus, Twitter. My dragon friend added me. There's a couple of that. Wait, this isn't the Might and Magic.
Okay. I
kind of
like that one.
So yeah, check. Anyways, I'm an old one on the group, so I don't really have a vote in this survey, but I totally feel like skewing the results now. Anyway.
Well, that's half the fun of silly survey answers like that.
True.
Why else would they exist if not to skew the statistics?
Exactly. So that's awesome. And all right. So, just before we dive into the main topic, a little bit of follow-up from the previous episode, and this from me, not from an outside. I just wanted to apologize for the very poor audio quality in the most recent podcast episode, or, well, at least for the first few hours that it was up. I got an initial listen of it, and I'm just like, wow, that's awful. So I went back. It was a crazy evening, and I had a thing, actually, that I had to, like, I got home. And I helped my wife get the kids out the door for Taekwondo. And then I had about 15 minutes to quickly get ready for my own new thing. So I cut down my preparation to like 5 minutes. I spent the last 10 minutes re-exporting the audio from Audacity after, you know, confirming, okay, this does sound better. And then once I got to the thing, I got there a little bit early. So I just fired on the tethering on the phone, quickly uploaded the episode uploaded the new audio and then republished it. So, fortunately the new audio is the one that got all of the listens. There weren't, comparatively speaking, a ton, but anyways, I actually don't know what happened. So not good. I had thought maybe that I had selected the wrong mic, but no, that turned out not to be the case. It was just something with the audio was messed up. I guess at the point that I initially imported it into Audacity, re-importing it seemed to fix the problem. So you know what? We'll go with that. And, but anyways, very poor. I apologize. And I mustn't let that happen again. All right. So one of my favorite, apocalyptic images, if you can call it that, was written by a columnist named John Zmirak in an article entitled Lust for the Suburbs. And I mean, he was commenting on a variety of social issues, you know, that in his view threatened to upset the social fabric of the West. But he concluded the article thusly. If it turns out that the geniuses running our banks and bureaucracies really have plunged our continent back to the status quo of, say, 1492, I will make my final pilgrimage back to the holy city, New York, because Mirek has an affinity for the city. I'll climb the stairs of the Chrysler Building, bring along my laptop, and I'll keep on watching YouTube till the Wi-Fi flickers out. I love that image, you know. And it was this passage that I was actually echoing. I know, right? It's like I mean, You know, we think of like, you know, the lights and things going out, but so much of our society now depends on that idea of being connected and online. And just it's interesting to think that if society really does fall down on its face at some point, there's going to be, you know, just this, the internet's going to just linger on for a little bit and then all the connection will just drop.
Poof.
Anyways, gone. And then we actually have to talk to people again. And
yes.
That is when the world ends.
Say it isn't so.
So anyways, it was this passage that I was echoing when I wrote the last line of my post from August 26, 2014. If the game gets shut down on the 28th, well, maybe we'll be lucky enough to be in the middle of something in-game when the signal flickers out. I mean, we can hope, at least. I was speaking, of course, about Ultima Forever, Mythic Entertainment's short-lived resurrection of the Ultima namesake. Initially, it was pitched as a PC game, but it was ultimately reworked and released on iOS, Apple's mobile operating system. Android and PC versions were touted, but ultimately never materialized. The game servers were shut down at 9:08 a.m. Mountain Time on August 29th, 2014. The game had been released globally on August 8th, 2013, after an extended period of beta testing in a handful of regional iOS app stores. So the definition of forever in this case turns out to have been a year and 21 days.
Forever's a lot shorter than I thought it was.
Yeah, I know, right? It's, man, that ruins so many country songs for me. It's only fair that you know forever's as far as I'll go. Really? Really? That's it? Yeah. It's, you know, it's honestly, it's even difficult to find a way to start talking about Ultima Forever. I was really heavily invested in the game, personally, emotionally, and even now I still kind of feel impacted by its loss. Sorgon Dragon and I don't think a month goes by where we're not just like, I wish that game was still around, man. Of course, what I'm feeling, and to be fair, my level of involvement and investment in the game, it obviously pales in comparison to what the Ultima Forever team at Mythic must have felt when the studio was shut down at the end of May 29th, 2014. And I don't want to try and, I don't want to try and put myself above that. And it actually has been with considerable relief that I've seen various people from Ultima Forever's development team end up on different game design teams, some within EA, some at other companies. Jeff Skalski, the producer, for example, is now working on Assassin's Creed. He's at Ubisoft. So, I think Ubisoft. Assassin's Creed, anyway.
Yeah, that's Ubisoft.
Still. Right. Still, Ultima Forever was something that, you know, in my own way, I did contribute to, and I stuck my neck out for it a fair bit, vocally supporting it to the Ultima community. Not that I'm not used to being a contrarian in the Ultima community. I mean, I'm a staunch defender of Ultima 9 as well.
Oh, how could you?
But I know, right? Oh, Ed, that's not even the half of it.
I defend Ultima 9 myself, so.
Aha.
At least we have the company
of
each other.
Also say, yes, well, there we go. There we go. But here's where I'm the real, here's where I get to be the uber contrarian, in that, you know, I often actually, and I do honestly feel this way, and I make a point of mentioning it a lot of times in debates, is that I actually generally tend to prefer playing Ultima 9 to Ultima 7. I mean, Ultima 6 is still my big thing, but yeah, that's usually when people are just like, what?
Hey, I can understand that argument.
Yeah. You know, and I mean,
I don't know if I agree.
I know there's so much more to it.
It's been a while since I've played Ultima 7 to properly compare it to, but I can understand it at least.
There's a lot of good stuff about Ultima 7, but if I have to fight anything, it's one of those games, you know. I think we kind of talked about that back in the combat episode.
Oh my, yes.
And it is not a game that can be pacifisted.
That's a weird sounding verb.
Yeah, well, it's actually probably not the weirdest sounding one I've ever invented, so I'm gonna go with it.
Hey, it works. That's all it needs to do.
Exactly. So, anyways, reactions to Ultima Forever were mixed, I suppose you could say. Some people just despised the game, and even went so far as to label it a desecration of the Ultima IP. And I'm actually not exaggerating with that term. Eurogamer's review used that exact phrase, desecration.
That's a little hard.
I know, right? It's just like, really? Others greatly enjoyed the game, though, or at least the gameplay and the story. The freemium layer, Ultima Forever was a free-to-play title, after all, was almost universally hated. And, I mean, it deserved a lot of the criticism that it got. Certainly, I mean, in my correspondence with Mythic, I certainly submitted my own share of criticism of the system as well. we'll talk about that more in a bit. But, you know, in reviews such as massively, I mean, they're just part of Engadget now, but still, you know, Ultima Forever was labeled as, say, a joy and praised for being an excellent example of an RPG on a mobile platform. Which it was, truly. And again, leaving aside the freemium aspects for the moment, you know, Ultima Forever was an excellent game, in spite of being unfinished. I liken it to Galaxy on Fire 2 in some respects. It might be a bit light content-wise when compared to, you know, PC games that very obviously inspired it or would be considered, you know, rough equivalents of it. But within the context of mobile gaming, it stands out as just a really excellent example of what the platform's capable of and of the excellent gaming experiences that the platform can deliver when the game just really pushes the boundaries. I don't know, Linguistic, have you ever seen the Avatar concept picture that was released?
Well, I'm sure I have at some point. I mean, I never had a chance to play Ultima Forever myself, as I was limited to just PC for a while, and then Android, which, as you've said before, never really materialized. But I was excited about it when news first came out, and I followed everything I could find about it. So I'm sure I've seen it at some point.
Probably. I mean, I know, or at least I'm very, very sure that I posted it to. But just in case, somewhere here. Gosh. I have so many emails about this. And maybe it was from his other account. Yeah, I gotta... you've almost certainly seen this, but you know what? We're gonna just page back in time. Or Gmail could take forever. I mean, whatever. It's just Google. All right, Biomythic calling a very short list of Ultima fans. No, that's not it. Pop author, maybe a whole heap of attention. Biomythic, Ultima, and you. Aha, there it is. So, hang on, I'll give you a screenshot. This is going to end up in the show notes, so don't worry, anybody, you're not going to be missing this, but just make sure Linguistic can see it. That one.
Oh, that's lovely. Oh, I know, that's right? Lovely.
There's a... I'll make sure that ends up in the show notes. And I think it got posted to the Codex or the Ultima Forever subdomain at one point.
I'm sure it did.
This was the very first piece of... Yeah, this was the very first piece of concept art that was released. And I mean, this was like in the initial email that was sent out to those of us who... a lot of us ultimately came to beta test the game, but... at the time, like, they were still just rounding up. They weren't even ready for that. Like, they were still like asking us to spot check their history of Ultima Forever website. So let's talk about that a little bit. Let's talk about where this all began. Okay. So in about July of 2010, Paul, yes, I know. Right. Paul Barnett, who at the time was the creative director at Mythic, he ultimately became the studio GM before its closure. He began reaching out to members of the Ultima fan community. I was actually one of a few people, evidently, that he had contacted. Possibly the only one who responded affirmatively. I seem to recall talking with Dino about it, Dino the Dark Dragon, and Dino mentioning that he'd been contacted as well, but that he declined at the time. But my memory's kind of muddy. by September that same year, after I'd helped Barnett pull together a list of people who'd be willing to serve as sounding boards for Mythic ideas and concepts for bringing back the Ultima franchise, that was Barnett's ultimate goal, what he considered to be his job, find ways to revitalize Ultima. And initially, he had this idea of like a three-pronged approach. Find a way to release the original Ultima games DRM-free and for free to the community, perhaps through GOG. So that was the first thing. Second one was find a way to release the Ultima games on new platforms, the original Ultima games on new platforms, mobile, console, whatever, and accompany this with an officially supported History of Ultima website. And then the third was develop and release a new Ultima game. Now, at first, to test sort of the vitality of Ultima in the modern market, it was supposed to be a small budget online game. Further down the road, larger budget single-player RPG was possibly on the table, as would other projects be, to carry Ultima into other markets. The first goal came to fruition, more or less. All the Ultima games are available on GOG, as well as on EA's Origin storefront. Not all of them are available for free, sadly. Although at GOG you can get Accalibeth, Ultima 4, Savage Empire, and Martian Dreams for free.
Which isn't too shabby.
Yeah. There's a bit of a story about the process of actually getting the games up on GOG, and that might be fodder for another podcast. We won't go into it now, I don't think. But I was in on most of the back and forth that went on, and it's kind of interesting how it all shaped up. The second goal, it didn't really go anywhere either. And this is something I've mentioned before. I'd love to see the Ultima games ported to mobile in... what are you doing to me here? There we go. So the second goal really didn't go anywhere. I'd love to see the Ultima games ported to mobile. I've talked about that on this podcast, actually.
We had a whole
likening it to how... yes, absolutely. And actually, in a couple of places, I mean, one, yes, just getting the games running on mobile. Obviously, we did that back in episode 13. But then also in the E3 episode, you know, I kind of made a point of calling out how Square has all these excellent mobile ports of the Final Fantasy games. And I just, you know, it's like, I really wish EA would do that.
Hit, hit, with, wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Well, yeah. So, and then there was the third goal, of course, you know, develop and release a new Ultima game. And that's kind of what we're here to talk about. So, Barnett's initial code name for what became Ultima Forever was, fittingly, called Avatar, a game which was pitched thusly. So, you know, in Avatar, you are from the planet Earth, and you are drawn through the internet to the world of Ultima. There you are seen as a possible savior to the land, a possible avatar. Your quest, if you decide to take it on, takes you through the world on a journey of self-awareness and personal growth, and you embark on a mission to build up your personal virtues. This is a world where the enemy is all inside you. It's a mission to do the right thing as you strive to show true courage, or to show truth, courage, and love. On your quest, you visit the eight towns, help citizens discover and discover and best the eight dungeons and meditate, yes, at the eight shrines. Your journey takes you across the oceans into conflict with pirates, into the lost islands, and ultimately to the Stygian Abyss. It's a mission that takes you on the traditional hero's journey. Avatar acts as a way to talk about the real and the digital world we live in and how you can affect things far away from you in ways that may not always be obvious, much like carbon offsetting or recycling your trash or communicating through Facebook and Twitter. The virtual you is measurable. Your digital dream avatar has a digital soul, an imprint that's as valid as anything you do in real life. There are no save points, no practice runs. Avatar is a metaphor for 21st century morals. So the intent there was really always to produce kind of a reimagining of Ultima 4 rather than a straight up port. The focus was to be on, you know, choices and consequences, and the big baddie in the game was meant to be you. As much as was possible, it was supposed to be the game your dad played, an Ultima worthy of the label rather than an appropriation of the namesake. It was meant to have the tarot cards, the gypsy, the eight virtues, classical Britannian setting, and at the same time it was supposed to be something new, you know, Lady British instead of Lord British. It was a bit more simple in its architecture, so it didn't have the world simulation features of Ultima 6 and Ultima 7. And at the time, it was being built as a browser-based game. And I just wonder if I have them here somewhere. Saved, what folder would that be in? Probably here. Yeah, there we go. It's like some of the design considerate. yeah, you don't want to. So, you know, some of the design considerations that and again, not all of this made it into the final game, but, you know, some of the stuff they were looking at, do we have a hierarchy of survival in the game? You know, at the beginning, it's about rations and health, knowing how to stay away from the dangerous monsters, learning how to fight. Then you have that core sense of morality, the virtues. You take on tasks. You have a respawn point. You meet people online. On the same quests often, you befriend them. There was no PvP. Friendship was really kind of the focus there. We'll talk a little bit more about that. As you progress, you gain achievements. You can counter and survive difficult areas, gain an understanding of other people who are doing and perhaps excelling in the same tasks. From them you can learn. You can strive to excel at the virtues. You can find elegant solutions to quest hurdles. Complete the game and enjoy yourself. So,
well, we talked last time about how many things Ultima 4 did differently, but how limited it was by the technology of the time. When I first saw what they were doing with Ultima Forever, I thought it was, you know, basically Ultima 4 updated and expanded for what we're capable of today. And from what you're telling me of the design documents here, that's pretty much what it looks like.
Yeah, in a lot of respects. And actually, you know, to Mythic's credit, Ultima Forever is still the only game where I've had a, you know, moral decision point thrust at me that has actually stopped me in my tracks. That I've actually had to, like, put the game down for a minute and think.
Which is a sign of a good, well-designed choice.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, not that the BioWare games, like Mass Effect and Dragon Age, it's not that, you know, I'm not trying to say they're poorly written, and I'm not trying to say they're poorly designed, but certainly the decision-making in those is, at least I found it to be, relatively clear-cut. That may not be everyone's experience, but, you know, for me, I play through those games and it's just like, well, is this the right thing or the wrong thing to do? Well, that's not, you know,
good choice, it's bad never really choice, the neutral choice.
More than a, exactly. It's not really a lengthy deliberation. Ultima Forever, then it was almost able to trip me up. Well, once in particular, and a couple times as well, I think, outside of that. Let's skip ahead a bit. So that was kind of in 2010, and really most of what was happening is, like, they were putting together their Ultima History site, and they wanted us to kind of contribute thoughts and commentary and, serve to maybe sound out some ideas for a game. So let's skip ahead to May 2011. At the time, I was still employed with Honeywell's Industrial Cybersecurity Solutions Group, and I was actually sent to Saudi Arabia for a couple of weeks. Yeah, I left Canada on May 5th, returned on the 19th. And then, a week after my return, I was on a plane again, this time bound for Fairfax, Virginia. Of course, I didn't say where I was going at the time, and I actually didn't follow up on the promise to post pictures of the trip. One commenter on the... I know. I don't even remember if I took that many pictures. I still actually have to go and look through my Lightroom libraries to see if I actually took much in the way of pictures. One commenter of the Codex did guess where I was headed. I was circumspect about it at the time. And you know what? If nothing else, I can always post that picture that Joe Garrity took of those of us who came to visit his basement. We'll get to that in a moment. I don't remember all the details of the weekend so well. I remember that we met first at a pub in Alexandria on the evening that I flew out. And as I recall, that went until pretty late. And that was, so there were five of us that were specifically invited out there. And then, of course, a lot of people from Mythic were along for the ride as well. And then afterwards, some of us, Dragons and Mythic developers alike, we ended up in Joe Garrity's basement, wherein we got a first-hand look at the Origin Museum. Joe had actually... I know.
You know, insert wonderful. Jealousy
Joe
here.
Joe had gone all... Yeah, that's the picture I'm referring to. He snapped a shot.
Or dare I say, covetous. Was there.
Yes, well, you know. Well played.
It's what I do.
So I know, right? So he and Joe, to his credit, I mean, he had gone all out. He had three, I think, computers set up running different ports of Ultima 4. And like, these were the original computers. So he had like, I think an Apple II, I think a C64, and then like some old DOS era PC, each running their respective port of Ultima 4. And then he had mead to drink as well.
Even better.
You know. I know, right? Fitting.
Very much so.
So that was a really, really great night. It went very, very late and we all had a really good time with it. The next day we all met at Mythic, and therein, in a back room past a large open space full of people frantically working on level design for Star Wars The Old Republic, because at the time Mythic was BioWare Mythic, and basically every BioWare studio that had any spare bandwidth was helping build The Old Republic. So it was actually really cool to like watch how they were creating levels and scenery for the game. But anyways, past all of that, in this little back area, we found the Ultima Forever team, just a handful of them really, who were waiting to show us their good work. And I mean, it was a full day. We had a few presentations. We got to discuss Ultima and the design of Ultima Forever with the team. And we got to play the game. It was still web-based at the time. Although the graphical look and feel had largely been established. And that went on until pretty late as well. And then dinner with the Mythic folks went on even later. We only had that one day to preview the game, of course, and we all parted ways and returned to our respective homes the next day. But it was a pretty exciting opportunity even so. And, you know, it really showed that within that, not even a year, right? They had really started to put something together that was really, really quite compelling. And I mean, I've got, and I'll try to remember to include links in the show notes. Like, I've got other articles that have been written showing like more the graphical evolution of the game, showing the evolution of its map. So we were already actually on, by the time we saw it, it had already been iterated on a fair bit. Linguistic, when we're done recording, I'll show you some of those articles. In late 2011, Paul Barnett reached out again, and this time he was asking for a longer list of volunteers who would serve as alpha and beta testers for the Ultima Forever PC client. So there again, that shows you kind of just how fast things were iterating for this project. Somewhere between May and October of 2011, the decision was made to move away from the web-based game and instead to package it as a standalone PC title. I think in total I pulled together around 60 names, and most of them were in on the eventual alpha test. We'll talk about that in just a little bit, but what I want to draw out here at this point is that this is, I think, where I started seeing indications of the freemium model creeping in to how Barnett spoke about the game. His idea for rewarding the beta testers in particular was to give them a huge bank of in-game credit and then a big pool of free items as well. And then never withdraw these bonuses when the game went live, of course, so that in his words, you know, people would be playing for free forever.
And we know how long that
we also discussed, you know, yeah, well, yeah. We also discussed, you know, the possibility of creating like a special in-game item for backers and how that might be styled. I mean, I remembered suggesting the Silver Serpent symbol be used for this, since the Ankh symbol was already... Yeah, I know, right? The Ankh was already fairly apparent on a lot of gear in the game. The other option was maybe the pointed Ankh that graces some of the UDIC branding. This all proved to be moot, of course. In the end, the gear was never created, and indeed the planned rewards never materialized either, probably because the PC beta test never went ahead. But there was the alpha test, and I still actually have the alpha client installed on my PC here. And I think I have a copy of the installer saved somewhere. According to my email history, the download link for the first alpha client was sent out on July 12th, 2012. The same day, coincidentally, that the game was formally announced for PC and iPad. And it ran for a few days. I don't remember quite how long. I do remember that I didn't get to play all that much of it, but I was able to grab a few screenshots, and I'll include those in the game. But maybe just again for your benefit, Linguist. Oh, God, where would I even have those? Blogging, Codex, Media, Ultima Forever? No. Oh, of course. Duh. Gaming. Playthrough pictures. Go away hangouts. Other. Ultima Forever Alpha Test. Yes, there we go. Cool. Open with... Oh, yeah, of course, you need to download that now, don't you? So anyways, now it's worth... Oh, of course, yeah, hang on, I'll just click on through to that one. All right, fine, you know what? Look, I love OneDrive, but, yeah, so I mean... Where's my... There's the Hangout client again. Screen share! Screen share! There we go. So yeah, like, here's... what it looked like back then, right? It was a little bit more simplistic UI.
Still pretty nice.
And, yeah.
Gets the point across.
Yeah, but the in-game, the UI, yeah, I know. The UI changed a lot. The in-game graphics were mostly set by this point in time. So, anyways, we're done screen sharing, I guess. Now, it's worth mentioning, actually, a word on the plot of the game to this point, because still intended at the time as more of a straight-up reboot of Ultima, beginning with the story of Ultima 4. Ultima Forever's story involved being enlisted to solve the theft of the Codex of Ultimate Wisdom. In some respects, there is nothing wrong with this, but as Sirgorn and others pointed out, I gather Shadow of Light Dragon sent in a novel's worth of commentary.
It would not surprise me.
Yeah. this maybe wasn't the best idea for the story, especially if it meant that the point of the game was to once more recover the Codex from the Abyss. You know, it was kind of this weird tension in that, you know, we want to have a game that's set after Ultima 4, but we're kind of telling a more or less the same story again. Anyways, Sirgorn's take on things was that one of the crown jewels, perhaps Lord British's crown itself, or I guess Lady British's crown, as the case may be, should have been what was stolen. In Ultima Forever, in this initial version of the story, the power of the Codex was being used to keep the Gazer Mimiro and his daemon hordes at bay, and the crown could have easily fit that same role, because as I recall, it's never really explained what the crown does. The other crown jewels, their powers are enumerated.
Well, I mean, it makes sense, too. I mean, Gazers are magical beings, and crown negates that, so... Stands to reason.
There you go. Right. So, of course, its theft would thus imperil the realm. And it might have given Mythic some room to add depth to the Lady British character, since, you know, I mean, it would have introduced the opportunity for introspection and doubt on her part about her fitness to rule, would have given the citizens things to grumble about. And then, so, again, you know, so... And again, like the fast iteration here is going to become apparent again. July 12th, the alpha test goes out for PC. October 2012. So July 2012 to October 2012, it was announced that Mythic was being transitioned from an MMORPG studio to a mobile-focused studio. Ultima Forever was still being touted for PC at that point. German and Australian PC gaming magazines ran articles about it in November of the year. The testing focus of the game, however, certainly shifted toward mobile at that time, and in February of 2013, the game was re-announced for iPod Touch, iPhone, and iPad. And there was a pretty slick trailer that was produced. Still a fun trailer to watch. Mm-hmm. And this was also when it became apparent that the story of the game had changed. And I like to think, at least, that, you know, the dragons who tested the Alpha Client had a ton to do with this, because I know that Mythic just had binders full of feedback from all of us. Shadow in particular, but, you know, lots of people sent in lots of commentary. That, you know, I mean, I know that they were just overwhelmed by sorting through. But the plot of the game did change. No longer was the Avatar to be tasked with recovering a stolen codex. Players would now have to unravel the mystery of the Black Weep, a deadly plague spreading through Britannia, consuming all in its path. I got to remember to put up some screenshots of Moonglow, which in the game was nearly completely consumed.
Kind of nice to see the overtaken and
yes, ruined. Yes. So, somewhere else getting destroyed.
I love Moonglow.
Well, it's just more poignant that way, right? And actually, they even reissued the, they produced a limited run of cloth maps. And I actually gave my original cloth map, the one that doesn't have the weep on it, to Artful Gamer. I met him for lunch and we were talking about the game, and I'm just like, well, you know what? Here, have this. But so they also then reproduced the cloth map with the weep on it. So, and you can kind of see, I mean, I'll hold it up for linguistic. I think I've got the graphics. So you can see, like, you know, the darker green areas are where the weep has infected.
Oh, that's lovely.
So, yeah. There's Moonglow. Move it on to the camera. There's Moonglow. See, it's totally consumed. Cove was very near. Lock Lake was quite contaminated. Cove wasn't quite consumed, but it was getting there. So anyways, that was the thing. You know, now Britannia was facing this more existential threat, the Black Weep. Where's it from? What's causing it? What's spreading it? I actually happened to be out in New Jersey on another 2-week work trip at the time this announcement took place. So I actually took the opportunity to drive down to Fairfax over the weekend. Because what else was I going to do? That was a good trip. I spent most of Saturday at Mythic Studio. Well, no, that's not true. I spent Saturday morning. I got up really crazy early and I just started driving down the interstate. New Jersey, Maryland, circumnavigating DC and then into Virginia. I stopped for lunch at a mall in Fairfax, about 2 exits up from where Mythic's studio was. And then whilst at the mall, I wrote an article about this too, and it'll be linked in the show notes. I grabbed the traditional food of the Ultima Dragons, Cinnabons.
Of course.
Yes. And so I had a crate of cinnamon buns, of Cinnabons with me at Mythic's studio. So that was cool too. You know, showed up with that. And I mean, I got there kind of just after lunch, early afternoon. And I mean, I spent most of the rest of Saturday there, played build after build of Ultima Forever on their test iPads when I wasn't chatting with Paul or with Kate Flack, the designer, or taking pictures of Ultima Online and Ultima Forever development history. You know, they let me into the room where they showed off the history, they let me into the room where they had like all of the maps that they had developed, because they still had like all of the... They still had them all, like, you know, from the very first map they'd drawn up to all the different iterations and changes that they'd made to it, and how they wanted to They'd talked about approaching it in different ways. Like, should it be like one complete map, or can we zone this thing? Monoscale, dual scale, you know, it's all that stuff. And there's another time where Paul pulled me aside and we went down Mythic, that office that we had been in with all of the Star Wars developers back in 2011. That was on the second floor of the building, and then Mythic's offices otherwise were, I think, on the top floor. And it was kind of, at the time, I mean, they'd been, they'd had a bunch more people, so they'd really been making use of the space. But at this time, with development on SWTOR wrapped, the space was largely empty. It was mostly being used for storage. But he took me down there, and he pulled out a bunch of these posters for Ultima Online's the Spirit of Virtue expansion or new game or whatever. It never happened, ultimately. But, you know, just lots of, like, screenshots and pictures of character art and things like that. And he's just like, take pictures of all of this. You know, take pictures and post it and have fun with it. So I did. They're on the Origin Gallery now. I helped name a few items in the game. Stayed up way too late playing board games with the associate producer. Crashed on his couch. Made omelets the next morning. He introduced me to another mobile game called Space Team, which is you're basically the idea is that it's a multiplayer game. You can't play it single player, and the idea is that, you know, you're playing locally because you have to be able to talk to each other, and so each of you has like different controls, and they have like, you know, stupid techno babbly names. And what you get is the idea off the top, across the top of the screen, you see your spaceship and you're trying to run away from a supernova, right? And so the next thing is like this little bar where it starts telling you like things that need to be done, right? You need to turn this thing to that, or you need to push that button or whatever, right? And sometimes it's a thing that's on your control panel, and sometimes it's the thing that's on the other person's control panel. And you can have up to like four players, right? So the idea is you're basically all standing around yelling commands, you know, like, push the thingamajigger, you know, turn the flues nozzle to four. Oh, and then of course your ship is taking damage because it's running from a supernova.
Of course it is.
So periodically, like, the panels will like fizz out or like shake themselves loose, and if they do, then you have to like drag them back into position before they'll work again. It's a really great simulation of a Star Trek bridge, actually. Anyways, so we stayed up too late playing that too. Yeah, we were up too late playing the board game, and then we stayed up even later playing Space Team. But anyways, I wasn't tired the next morning at all, no. But I was that Sunday able, as I made my way back up to Jersey, I was able to meet the good Mr. Ian Fraser for dinner in Baltimore.
Nice.
And Mythic, actually, yes, and I had a cloth map of Ultima Forever to pass along to him with Mythic's compliments. So that was cool.
Nice.
I know. So, iOS was the path forward. Mobile was the path forward. Ultima Forever was soft launched on the Canadian iOS App Store and a few other app stores around the world in May of 2013. And the global release was slated for July. Richard Garriott actually gave the team his best wishes and later actually seemed to be quite enjoying the game. He'd post screenshots of it occasionally. He even got a tour of the Mythic Studios. And people around the world, because really it's not that hard to install an app from an app store that isn't your own country's, began testing the game. And the feedback began to pour in. And a lot of that feedback was, sadly, negative. And most of it was centered on the freemium model used by the game. Now, when Paul Barnett first explained the freemium model in the game to me, I was kind of dubious. And at the time, all he was proposing was that players would have to open chests with keys, okay? And the game would either top you up with a small number of keys daily, or would possibly like have lower quality keys drop off monsters as loot. And of course, you could also buy keys. But the idea was that you'd only have to spend keys to open chests that would appear at, you know, say, the completion of a dungeon. And, I mean, I was hesitant about that, even though it was a fairly modest proposal. And in hindsight, it actually probably would have worked. Sadly, apparently because EA wanted the game to be a lot more monetized, or so I suspect. Ultima Forever was also released with another unfortunate feature, that being gear decay. Now, gear decay isn't a bad thing in and of itself. I mean, Shroud of the Avatar is going to have it. Ultima Underworld had it. Gear decay isn't a bad thing in and of itself, but the cost, in keys of course, to repair gear was really, really high. You know, you could lose half of your kit in a single dungeon run, and it might take 4 or 5 dungeon runs to accumulate sufficient replacement gear. And trying a dungeon run without gear was suicide. Gear really mattered in the game. You felt it and hard when your armor gave out.
And that's just bad balance.
Yeah, well, I mean, in some respects, you know, it makes sense, right? Because if I'm running a dungeon with plate armor and all of a sudden it gets broken off of me and now I'm running a dungeon in my underwear, I'm going to have a bad day.
Which makes sense, yes. But when you factor in how expensive it is to get it fixed, that's where the balance, it's an economic balance issue rather than mechanics.
Exactly. And that was the real problem. You know, yeah, I didn't mind that armor actually had, you know, meaning in terms of how it impacted your ability to navigate combat. I was actually, in some respects, I think Ultima Forever had actually really quite meaningful armor in that sense. You know, it actually made a real hell of a difference, unlike in some of the other Ultima games that I could name, including my most favorite one.
Yeah.
But, but the cost of repair was just so, it was, you know, how's the meme go? Too damn high? Yeah, it was that. So even before the game went global, Mythic began to adjust downward the cost of repairing gear. And not just once, but I think twice. And then they adjusted upward the daily allowance of keys. They started running key sales and multiple key sales. They even delayed the worldwide release of the game in order to smooth out the economy issues still yet further. And they never did really get it right, unfortunately. Even after the worldwide release, it was, you know, still something that Mythic tried to fix. They tried to make work. And then finally, they just removed equipment damage from the game. Mostly. If you died in a dungeon, your gear would still take damage. But it was no longer getting damaged if, you know, monsters just hit you. But I think by that point, it was too late. And I actually still maintain that if they had just added the option to pay a one-time fee, even $10, which is on the high side for a mobile game, to remove the key requirement entirely, Ultima Forever could have worked. Anyways, the game was released worldwide August 8th, 2013, as we already said, culminating about 3 years, maybe a little more, of tumultuous development. The game wasn't finished. Only 2 character classes out of the planned 8 had been included in the game. Ship travel, which had been present in the alpha, had been removed for the time being, mostly because I guess it was a really hacky system and they didn't want, you know, to leave that in as the final system. They wanted to put in something better rather than trying to work with the hacky thing and then graft on new features to it.
Makes sense.
It was slated to be re-added later on, but I mean, obviously, some of the towns and the dungeons were just plain inaccessible. Serpent's Hold and I believe Vesper stand out as notable examples there. Although I have the art. I have the in-game art. I've posted that. They were both fortresses. You couldn't get to the Isle of the Avatar either. And even in the areas of the game that you could explore, you'd occasionally spot, you know, a missing texture, a blank NPC portrait, things like that. And then, of course, some of the missing character classes, too. Like, I mean, I had no idea what they were going to do for the Bard. I know we saw some art for the Paladin, not in game, but like in some of the games.
Can only wonder imagery what they would online. Have done for Shepherd.
The Druid. Yeah, totally wonder what they would have done for Shepherd. We talked a little bit in the combat episode about what they had planned for Druid. You know, she was supposed to be pure pacifist, not even able to attack. Yes, and they were having some issues with getting the mechanics working, but, you know, that would have been really cool.
Yeah, it would have been different.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, they had a lot of great ideas, just, you know, because they could never get the part of the game where it made money working right, and probably couldn't ever get the game to actually make money as a result, never really got to see that. And so, you know, just over a year after its global launch, the game was shut down. And, I mean, the writing was kind of on the wall by about February of 2014. That was when a new update for the game allowed all players to complete the quest of the Avatar. You know, and I mean, this when, you know, I knew going in that only a third of the plot had been implemented. Based on, you know, what their ultimate plan for it was. And so, you know, I and many others took this correctly as a sign that new content development had largely ceased. The update was followed by a quick fix to the chat system in May, and then not even a week thereafter, Mythic was shuttered. Ultima Forever lingered for a couple more months, its status uncertain, but then by the end of July, its fate was sealed. There was a formal announcement that its online services would be closed down. Now, and I mean, I think it was kind of one of those things where, you know, Mythic, when they went to mobile, and I know this, you know, from like looking at Kate Flack's LinkedIn profile, they were trying tons of ideas. They were just kind of almost throwing stuff against the wall, seeing what would stick. And one thing that did stick was Dungeon Keeper. Dungeon Keeper is still going today. Dungeon Keeper for mobile is still going today. And I mean, I remember playing it, and it's a fun enough game. Again, it was one of those things where, you know, the mechanics are great, the freemium's terrible, but for whatever reason, it worked. It made money, whereas Ultima Forever didn't. And that's really, I think, unfortunate, because...
Agreed.
I mean, you know, not to knock Dungeon Keeper, but it's no Ultima.
Can't put it any better than that.
Yeah. I did play that game for a little while, and I mean, I enjoyed it for what it was for, but it was definitely, you know... You pop in for a minute, you have your imps do some stuff, and then they got to do it for like 2 hours, so you just, you know, close out of the game and go on with your day. Whatever. But yeah, I mean, I think that one just kind of got ahead, and that was it. Still, for all that we can criticize... And I mean, this is kind of really the shame of it, I think. You know, for all that we can criticize the freemium model that Ultima Forever had, and we can, I really don't want to lose sight of something important. Ultima Forever was a great example of a mobile RPG, and that's something of a rarity these days. You know, the RPG space on mobile is cluttered with, well, I mean, okay, if you look under the RPG category on, like, the iOS App Store, you've got games like Game of War Fire Age, which may have Mariah Carey now. It's not Kate Upton anymore. But it's no RPG. It's really more of a light strategy game. Now, there are a lot of JRPGs that have found their way to mobile. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with a JRPG. I don't want to sound like there is. They're fine. Many people enjoy them. But there aren't a lot of great Western-style RPGs on mobile. And there are a few examples that really stand out... the few examples that really stand out are either straight-up action titles with correspondingly shallow plots. Gameloft's Dungeon Hunter series, for example. This is like a very lightweight dungeon siege. And honestly, the gameplay is good, but the level of storytelling makes Dungeon Siege seem positively masterful. On the other hand, you do have more in-depth titles, Raven Sword or The Shadow Sun, but the controls are just wonky. Just utterly not good. Ultima Forever was a particularly rare blend, I mean, still to this day, I, you know, periodically just cruise through. I look and even test, look at and test all sorts of mobile games that, you know, outwardly seem promising. It doesn't come close. Nothing comes close. They had this great blend of solid, easy to control gameplay, and an engaging story and plot. I mean, okay, it was a story that took a little while to get going, and I remember digesting so much of it on what I dubbed Play Ultima Forever Day, August 28th, 2014, the day before the server shut down. And I remember just thinking on that day just how great this story was. Of course, it was just as much fun to go ripping through dungeons alongside Fenix from the Wiki team, who rented an iPad specifically for that day.
I should have.
And I mean, yeah, you could have joined us. I holed up in a Starbucks for the entire day and just played. But, you know, as we went, we just found, you know, a story that kept getting better, albeit one that was unfinished. But, like, you know, there was this great moment at the Shrine of Compassion where we had found the bell and the book and the candle and we summoned them and, you know, or we used them and we summoned, like, you know, the demon Horath and his various minions, the Gazer and Mimiro. And it's like, all right, cool. This is like going to shape up as some sort of pivotal battle. And then, no, Horath just like hand waves it all away and we barely escape with our lives.
Wow.
Just like, whoa, okay, that was insane. It was an insane moment. But anyways, I think ultimately to defeat those demons, you would have had to have gone into the Stygian Abyss. And I have the art for some of their areas. Again, on the Origin Gallery. Their ideas for the Abyss were awesome. They had some pretty cool stuff drawn up. I really do wish, actually, that Mythic had a chance to fully implement the plot of the game, which would have dealt not just with solving the threat of the Black Weep, but which would have looked forward to the corruption of Lord Blackthorn, because, of course, they did want this to be part of a series of titles, each of which kind of, you know, presented a new take on the events of the successive games in the series. So they were looking forward to the events of Ultima V. Paul Barnett actually kind of likened this to sort of like the new Star Trek, the J.J. Abrams Star Trek, right? Where it's basically, there's like this, you know, they're not trying to tell stories to replace the original canon. They're basically saying, okay, we just have this wrinkle in time that has completely set us on a new but parallel path of storytelling. So, you know, that's Britannia as we know and love it, and it happened that way. And here is Britannia if one thing had gone differently, and how do we proceed from there?
What happened off camera?
Exactly. Or, yeah, what could have happened if, you know, something else had happened differently? Lord British leaves and leaves his daughter in charge.
A supposal, as C.S. Lewis would have called it.
Yes. And I mean, they had this idea of, like, you know, like Lord Blackthorn was supposed to be in the game. He was actually supposed to be kind of a goodie. And you can hear him
He
was supposed to be an enemy in the Yeah, well, he wasn't supposed to be an enemy in the game, but you would encounter, and I mean, he ultimately wasn't in the game at any point during its release. But he was, you know, planned for inclusion at some point, and he was supposed to be not an enemy. But, you know, he was alluded to in some dialogue in the game as being somehow involved with a group of nobles who were fomenting unrest against the rule of Lady British. His castle was on the map. And actually, when I was playing at Mythic, you were able to explore it, but some of the scenes inside hadn't been added, so you went through the wrong door, and it was just crash.
How's that for a trap in the room?
Yeah, so I've won now, Avatar. You've been deallocated by the heap manager. Let's see Lord British bring you back from that.
That!
Avatar, your memory address is 0.
Oh, boy.
And actually, one of the other strengths of Ultima Forever was the way that it handled group play. Grouping was totally ad hoc. There weren't any guilds, at least not in a formally supported sense, or anything of that nature. Players would group up before heading into a dungeon and would share in the rewards of the instance. There was no PvP. Some people didn't like that. But adding PvP to the game really would have gone against Mythic's design goal,
exactly,
which is to foster and encourage players to cooperate and help each other. Indeed, more experienced players would gain in virtues like sacrifice by helping lower level players navigate dungeons. And the design of the dungeons actually was pretty great. The plot critical dungeons had fixed layouts, they took a fair bit of time to explore. And they were full of little secrets for, the more clever players to uncover. If you had Blink, you could have some real fun with Blink. In terms of getting to, little hidden chests and things like that. The side dungeons were often randomly generated, which I'll grant isn't everyone's cup of tea, although it did serve to make them excellent locales for grinding, since it didn't really feel like you were wandering through the same cave each time. The mage was a bit overpowered. It was pretty easy to just kite through battles, flinging magic at enemies. And in a neat touch, if you listened closely, you could actually hear the mage intone the words of power for the spells they were flinging at enemies. It wasn't always easy to hear that over the soundtrack and the sounds of pitched battles, but the incantation was there. It was neat. I found a few Easter eggs, too, as I was going through things. Some stuff that, Paul had emailed over the years. The spirituality quest. Because there were, they had quest plans for each of the eight virtues. And the spirituality quest actually begins the moment the player starts playing the game. There are achievements, hidden achievements. You as the player don't see them until they're relevant. Hidden across the world that are designed to find out what sort of player you are. And if you're the kind who explores every hidden area, there's a spirituality unlock for that. If you click and fiddle on every object you can, there's unlocks for that too. NPCs ask some pretty soul-searching questions. Do you believe in life after death? Is love at first sight real? By the time the quest is complete, the player might just have learned something about themselves. But the whole idea is that, the entire fabric of the world was really architected around that quest. Trying to think. And if you stood in the Shrine of Spirituality long enough, you would see the Normandy from Mass Effect. There was a hidden Kilrathi. Actually, two. There was a crashed Kilrathi ship and then also a statue of a Kilrathi head on a couple of the islands off the coast of Britannia. And then there were honesty boxes in some of the dungeons, which were kind of an implementation of the old prisoner's dilemma. Basically, if you were in a group, one player in the group would see the honesty box. And you could either take all the loot for yourself, and I believe you were penalized honesty for that, or you could share it with the group. And I just realized, actually, that linguistic has completely dropped out, and that's so terribly unfortunate, and I hope that, oh dear, that's really quite unfortunate. Well, you know what? I'm going to keep going for a moment, and if I can get linguistic back, I'll get linguistic back. And if not, maybe I'll wind up re-recording this. We'll see. Anyways. Gosh, it's hard to go through all of this just for the sheer, I don't even know. The artwork for the game was gorgeous. And I don't just mean the in-game graphics. The virtue cards, the major and minor arcana cards, they were created for the game and used in the game. They're just excellent pieces of art in their own right. Some of them quite poignantly depict the associated virtue. The compassion card, for example, it shows the background is like a city in flames. And the
I'm back. Sorry. Router wigged out for a second.
All right, you're back. What you are not is back in Zencaster.
One second.
So I don't know if we will be able to recover you. I hope.
I guess we'll find out, won't we?
Yeah. Well, I'll hop back in on that at any rate.
Working on it.
And... Anyways, until you're back, I was just kind of commenting on the artwork for the game. And I don't just mean, like I was saying, I don't just mean the in-game graphics, the virtue cards in particular. Yes. So, the, there you are.
There we go.
Yeah, the virtue cards in particular were really quite excellent because, you know, you have the image on compassion, for example, you know, it shows in the background this city aflame, and then you've got the bard cradling this little child. So just like, whoa, that's kind of really deep. I remember working on some of the moon phases on these cards too. You know, trying to make sure they were right. So there isn't a lot that remains of Ultima Forever. The artwork, though, has slowly been finding its way into Ultima Online. The Vice Versus Virtue event that they ushered in last year uses the major
arcana. Ugh, and those are lovely.
And I've been... some of those are really, really great.
the liar that they used for deceit. The smirking man behind the elaborate mask. Oh, I love it.
Yeah, or... which one is she? Crap, I gotta look now. There was one in particular. Oh, which one is it? It's the, what? No, I don't care about that. Just... Media. Major Arcana. There we go. Looking. The Saint? Yes, the Saint. I love the Saint.
Scroll. Oh, yes, her...
And the sun. The sun's good.
You can't go wrong with a phoenix.
Phoenix. Yeah. So those have been making their way into Ultima Online. I've been seeing NPC portraits from Ultima Forever pop up on the UO website now and again. And of course, the soundtrack's available on Amazon, iTunes, Google Play. It's a pretty good soundtrack, although it tends towards a heavier style overall. And finally, I mean, I do still have the PC Alpha client installed. I've been able to extract a number of things from the data files. I've also got various other bits and pieces of artwork kicking around. So I'm going to attempt to collect these into one place, and I'll probably share them on the Codex at some point in the near future. All right. Well, it's late here, so I think we should wrap up. I don't know. I don't know if I really came to any particular conclusion on Ultima Forever. I just, there was a lot of this is just thoughts I needed to get out of
my head. It deserves being remembered. You
know, they've been swimming around for a year. Definitely. So always remember, if you'd like to recommend anyone for a shout out, send us an email, which you can also use to suggest podcast topics, offer commentary or criticism about the episodes, or volunteer your time as an occasional or regular contributor. UltimaCodex@gmail.com, or there's a contact form on UltimaCodex.com. As well, if you haven't already, and as you heard at the start of the session, we've had a lot of this, you should totally sign on with the Ultima Dragons group on Facebook or with the Ultima Dragons community on Google+. The Facebook group's the larger and more lively, but that just means that the Google+ one needs a few more members. There's also the UDIC hashtag on Twitter. As well, please consider liking the Facebook page for the Ultima series or following the Codex on Twitter or encircling us on Google+. And, you know, please consider sharing any content posted to those social media profiles with your own followers and friends. And if you like Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug in particular, leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or Podbean or, you know, anywhere that you listen to us. And of course, there's the Patreon. The $1 pledge is all you need to get access to Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug episodes the day before they go live on the Codex, and you'll be helping maintain and, with sufficient funding, expand the server infrastructure of the Codex to better deliver all the things you come looking for there at. So, Linguistic, where can we find you online?
Well, you can find me at ultimatejourneys.blogspot.com, where I've been documenting my way through the Ultima series and often tangenting into various game-related topics. And you can shoot me an email at linguisticdragon@gmail.com.
Alrighty. And for myself, you can find me on Twitter, WTF_dragon. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me at ultimacodex.com, of course, and you can also find me on about.me/Kenneth.Cooley, K-U-L-L-Y, any of those places. All right. Well, we're going to call it a night for tonight. So, yeah, thank you so much for tuning in. Linguistic, you want to sign off?
Until next time, folks.
That's right. And until next time, be virtuous.